From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection this hour goes back to 1920 in the wilderness of Alaska. In her wildly successful book, The Snow Child, author Eowyn Ivey tells a fictional story that seems, in many ways, anchored in the harsh Alaskan reality. She writes of a couple that moved from the heartland of the United States to the quiet loneliness of Alaska in search of something new, something perhaps healing. They had lost a child years before, and they wanted in some ways to escape. What follows is a riveting tale that seems to weave fantasy with truth, constantly asking the reader to evaluate what's happening on the page. Critics have loved the book, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Well, Writers and Books chose The Snow Child for their 2014 event, If All of Rochester Read the Same Book. Today, we welcome Joe Flaherty, Executive Director of Writers and Books. Good to see you, Joe.
Good. Thanks to be here.
And on the phone with us is the author in Alaska, Eowyn Ivey. Are you there, Eowyn?
I am. Hello. Thank you so much for having me on today.
Well, it's great to have you, and congratulations on all the great success with The Snow Child, which just seems to be coming in wave after wave for you.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's been an exciting ride for me and my family.
Let me warn you, and I will warn Joe and our audience, I'm going to do my best as a reader and the host not to give too much away of the book, but Eowyn, I've got you for the hour, and so we're going to try to get into some of this without giving everything away. Is that fair enough?
Yeah, I think that's a great idea to not ruin the ending for anyone who hasn't read it yet.
Very good. Joe, I would love for you to tell our audience how Writers and Books ended up choosing The Snow Child for If All of Rochester Read the Same Book.
Well, it's every year it's a very different process. We ask for suggestions from people during the each year's read of what they would like to see us do the next year. We ask librarians, you know, people in bookstores, you know, what you recommend. And then we end up as a staff at Writers and Books reading about, 25 books or so, narrowing down. And then we get to about three finalists. And a big part of it is whether that author can come to Rochester during the time that we do it. But the three are often, that has to be a really good read. It has to grab people's attention. It has to be something that we know that when we throw it out to the community, people are going to, pick it up and read and talk about it and be prepared when the author comes. And then that's it. We say, okay, we'll narrow down one by one. Can that person come? So in this case, we were lucky. Eowyn could make it, and that was really it was our final choice. But let me just say, one of the things we were looking for also is that we were actually looking for a first novel. Mm-hmm. We thought that there's so much publicity that goes into people who are already existing, novelists who have books out. But, what's happening out there with people who are doing their first novels? And this was just a great example of a wonderful first novel.
My take, 20 pages into this book, I was amazed at the quality of the prose because, Eowyn, let me tell you that you write so beautifully evocatively of the wilderness and the scenery without a shred of purple prose. And that is very difficult to do when you write that descriptively, to not hyperbolize. And yet, you did it beautifully, and I commend you for that. Give me a sense for your own background, and we'll talk about how the book sets up. But your own background as a writer and as someone who became an author is what?
Yeah, well, thank you so much for those kind words. I really appreciate it. I always loved fiction. I was an avid reader as a child, but I'm also kind of pragmatic, and so as a career, I chose journalism. I felt like that was a more practical way to earn a living, and so I got my degree in journalism, and I worked for almost 10 years for our local newspaper here as a reporter and editor and things like that. And then I did have this kind of point where I thought, wow, if fiction's really what I love and I want to make a go of it, I just got to do it. And so I left journalism as a field and went to work as a bookseller at our local independent bookstore, just so I would have kind of the time and the mental space to try to do some writing. And so that's how I had come into it. And I do think that journalism background was a great training for being willing to edit out words and kind of maybe simplify the language a little bit.
And now the story goes that you were well on your way to getting a book done when you shifted gears, and what happened?
Yeah, and it was a hard decision. What happened is I was working at the bookstore shelving books when I came across a retelling of the Snegorochka fairy tale. So this is a Russian fairy tale that has been around for hundreds of years. But it was a little Alaskan children's book, just a dozen or so sentences telling the story of an old man and a woman who can't have children and build a little glob of snow, and she comes to life. And when I read it there, it really was sort of a lightning bolt moment, which I don't usually believe in those kind of moments, but I thought, oh, this is it. This is the story I want to tell. But as you mentioned, I mean, I was probably a good three quarters into another novel. I had spent many, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years on. And so it took me some time to decide, like, am I being flaky if I just completely drop this other idea and start? And finally, I just thought, this is where my heart is now. So I just dove into it. And I had a first draft in about a year. So for me, it was a relatively quick process. I was excited about it.
And for our listeners, again, if you're just joining us, Eowyn Ivey, the author of The Snow Child, is on the phone with us. She is going to be here. Joe, give us a quick slate of events with Writers and Books, because I know you guys are excited.
Well, she's going to be here starting on, it's going to be Wednesday, March 19th, the 20th and the 21st. And there's going to be events that take place at Nazareth College, at the Greece Public Library, at Penfield Public Library, Central Library downtown. So there's going to be lots of opportunities for people to have a chance to hear Eowyn read from the book, talk about the book, and then ask her questions about it, and also comments. It's always great to hear comments of how different people interpreted the book in very different ways.
This is what Writers and Books do so well. The discussion groups and the events are phenomenal, and I don't know if you could have chosen a book that is more suited for debate and questions and trying to interpret and figure out what the heck did I just read? Eowyn's not going to, again, we're not going to give it all away, but we are going to start to get into that. But we're about 2 weeks away, and if you want to check out the full slate of Writers and Books events, where do they go, Joe?
They go to our website, which is wab.org, and then go to If All of Rochester Read the Same Book, and they can click on there, and there will be a whole a schedule of events taking place every day, actually, up to and including when Eowyn is here, and then afterwards also.
Eowyn, it is an achingly sad start to this book as we meet Jack and Mabel, a married couple, middle-aged married couple who 10 years prior had lost a child. They are childless, and they are living in Alaska facing another prospect of a difficult winter. Let me read a little passage here that is so striking to me. Here it is. When Mabel slowly straightened, the land was vast before her. The sun was setting down the river, casting a cold pink hue along the white-capped mountains that framed both sides of the valley. Upriver, the willow shrubs and gravel bars, the spruce forests and low-lying poplar stands swelled to the mountains in a steely blue. No fields or fences, homes or roads, not a single living soul as far as she could see in any direction. Only wilderness. It was beautiful, Mabel knew, but it was a beauty that ripped you open and scoured you clean so that you were left helpless and exposed if you lived at all. And I read that passage, Eowyn, and I thought only someone who has lived it as well could have written that.
Oh, thank you very much. You know, I really, for me, at least right now in my writing life, Alaska's really where I am excited about writing and trying to, you know, it's a complicated place, and I think most of us who live here have complicated feelings about winter and some of the harshness of the landscape. And so it was really, that was one of my main goals, was to kind of delve into that and try to really understand it a little better.
263-WXXI, 263-9994, if you want to talk to the author, Eowyn Ivey, of The Snow Child. So we meet Jack and Mabel, and they are, not to oversimplify, and these are not simple characters, that's the beauty of the writing here, but they are dealing with their own feelings of inadequacy. And I think that neither one of them realize how much they feel like they might be failing the other. They're sort of... they don't talk much, and it's very cold. So why did they go there? Tell us, Eowyn, why did Jack and Mabel go to Alaska?
Well, I think, and what I liked about what I wanted to do is, I think sort of the stereotype is that it's men who want to move to Alaska. And that is true. There are, you know, I think for a long time, men outnumbered women a lot here. But there are women that want to come here, too, of their own will. And I wanted to let Mabel be the one who says, hey, let's have this adventure. And in the 1920s, there were some, actually, I think believing beginning in 1918, there were some efforts to bring homesteaders up to Alaska. And so Mabel comes across one of these flyers that allows for cheap land, assistance in travel to get up here to homestead. And I think they come, as you mentioned earlier, as sort of a hope to start a new life, to try to build something new. And I think that's often what brings people to Alaska, is to sort of, you know, step away from a closed-in kind of life and just try something totally totally different.
But Mabel is the kind of person who went there looking for the solitude, and yet, early in the book, she has a suicide attempt because the solitude seems to have consumed her and forced her to consider all of the things that had broken her own heart.
Yeah, and again, I think that oftentimes, you know, people come to Alaska wanting to escape something else. And I wanted Mabel to come to this realization that you can't really escape your own inner turmoil and your own grief that way. And so in a way, the solitude that she thinks is going to sort of bring peace, in a way kind of amplifies her own loneliness and like you said, grief. And so, that was where I plop them down. At times I felt kind of bad because I was subjecting them to an awful lot in the beginning, but I always try to promise readers there is some hope and happiness as it goes along.
there's beautiful hope, and it starts when they are dealing with the prospect of the coming winter. They have very little money. They're relying on her pies to bring back a few bucks. She bakes pies and they take them to the hotel and they sell them there. And then they lose that deal and she can't sell the pies anymore. And literally it's to the point where Jack in middle age is thinking about going to the mine and doing what they call a young man's work. But set that scene for those of us who've never been in a winter wilderness. I mean, and look, by the way, when it was -6 here this morning, we've dealt with a long, cold winter. But we do know winter in Rochester. But
yes, you do. Absolutely.
But give me a sense for the challenge on kind of a frontier when you are entering November and December. You know, you've got long, long months. The daylight is very short. The conditions are raw, and it is hard enough just to have food to eat. Set that scene for what Jack and Mabel were facing.
Well, and you know what, that was one of the reasons I chose. People often ask why I chose the 1920s to set it. And one of the largest reasons is because I did want them to be kind of completely immersed in that landscape. In modern-day Alaska, we have a lot of conveniences. We have all the same conveniences of everywhere else. So, you know, if you don't cut enough firewood, almost everyone has electric heater backup and different things like that. But in 1920, even really in through the 30s, I mean, you're talking about very limited resources for people. And so when it is, you know, even as cold as you are all dealing with, if it's 10 below outside and you don't have enough firewood or you're having to go out and hunt in that kind of cold, it is, at times life-threatening. And so that's a new awakening, I think, for Jack and Mabel, this kind of, they've gone from, you know, a hard life, but not quite as extreme as it is in Alaska, I think.
And then, finally, something happens to give us hope. We've been dealing with these characters who are just almost lachrymose, and then all of a sudden, we get this dinner, and Mabel's uncomfortable, but there's a little bit of loosening up and a little bit of a spark, and they finally get snow, and she decides, and for a brief moment it felt out of character, but then you realize that this was almost this breaking of a dam for her, that she actually threw a snowball at Jack and was unsure how he'd react. And that little scene was not a little thing at all. It was a very big moment for a couple. And Mabel, for couples who've been married for many years, I think a lot of people will relate to the notion that when's the last time you looked at your spouse and smiled?
Yeah, and you know, it's funny because even though it's called The Snow Child, I think that really it's Jack and Mabel's story. It's the story of their marriage and how they have to, you know, I think you really captured it well, that they don't realize how much the other one is suffering or how much the other one feels like they're failing. And it takes a little moment of one reaching out to the other to maybe start to kind of to share a little more. And so, yeah, in that moment, they start to be a little bit playful in the snow as if they're, you know, a young couple again, and they build a little snow girl. And so that kind of sets things into motion from there.
So they build the snow girl, and they dress the snow girl. And remind our listeners who might have missed the story, this is where you get the closest translation of that. Is it a Russian fable or fairy tale
Yes, it is. It's called Snegorochka. That's the original fairy tale. You know, in Russia, I think it's a little bit like Cinderella or Snow White here. There's a lot of retellings of it. So there's been operas and ballets and different things. But it is that basic story. An old man and a woman build a little girl out of snow, and she comes to life.
And so they build their snow girl, and they give the snow girl some features, and then it's that night or the next morning. Is it that night that Jack is up and sees an actual girl, and their snow girl has been sort of knocked over and gone.
Right, exactly. So, yeah, they kind of just catch these fleeting glimpses of a little girl through the trees. And again, this was another decision I had to make about setting it in the time frame I did. I realized that if they're in modern times, I thought about setting it in modern times, but even in Alaska, if there's a little girl running around in the woods by herself, there's going to be certain authorities involved at some point pretty quickly. And I realized in 1920, you know, it would be a whole different world in terms of it would be up to Jack and Mabel to try to figure out who this little girl was and what she needed.
So she appears, and they figure she's no older than 8 or 9, and Jack sees her first, and is, as you might understand, when you're essentially out on your own and miles from town, and you don't really see any other people, and the winter is upon you, and you see a girl, and she's got a fox nearby, and then she runs off, and you can't get to her. You're a little spooked. You don't necessarily go right home and say to your wife, "Guess what I saw? I saw a girl, and I'm pretty sure it's that little thing that we built out of snow that has come to life." She might ask you if you have been hiding drugs in the house.
Exactly. And that is part of what happens in the beginning, because they're not communicating with each other at all. There is a lot of miscommunication about what's happening. And I think that Jack is concerned. He knows enough to be concerned about Mabel's mental well-being, and I think he doesn't want to add to that. So there's some time there where it's unclear exactly what they're seeing, what the other one knows.
We're talking to Eowyn Ivey, the author of The Snow Child, a Pulitzer Prize finalist and a smash success, a work of fiction that is coming to Rochester as Writers and Books chose it for their If All of Rochester Read One book. We're 2 weeks away from Eowyn Ivey being here herself for a number of events with Writers and Books, and have a great chance to kind of delve more into the book right here. So, okay, so now we've got the establishment of the girl and her fox, and then Mabel sees the girl, and eventually the girl shows up and just kind of watches Jack doing his work and follows him home and comes into the house that they share. And when this is where, I don't fully know how to say it as a reader other than to say it was such an important part of the book for me to fully believe it and buy into it, because it was fantastical, you know. Who was this girl, and is she real, and what are we actually looking at here? But you wrote it very understated. You know, it wasn't filled with too much overdone imagery. It was just this little dinner they had. How important was it for you to write that scene in a way that was sort of everyone's looking around the room going, what are we doing here?
Yeah, that was actually, I really loved, that was a fun scene for me to write, to just kind of imagine them actually having this very intimate encounter. And like you say, in a very regular, everyday setting, you know. And throughout the book, I think that was one of my goals, is although I love this fantastical potential of Faina, the Snow Child, I didn't want it to be a completely fantastical book. I wanted it to be very rooted and set in this life of a homesteader in Alaska in 1920. That was really important to me. So that was kind of how I approached each scene, was I wanted this little hint of magic that you could believe in or doubt or whatever, but know that this reality otherwise is very real.
And the girl is, you know, early on, Jack and Mabel are sort of assuming, well, maybe the girl grabbed some of the clothing off the snow child that we built her. They're not saying to themselves or not too overtly, well, we built a snowman and it came to life and that's this little girl. But the reader is instantly wondering, and there's a technique you use in the book that I thought was so well done, that when there is conversation and interaction with the girl, you do not use quotation marks, and it immediately creates a separation from reality that makes the reader wonder, is this because the child is not real? Are they imagining it? Is there something else at play here? Give me a sense for why you chose that device. And I'm also curious to know what your editors say. I mean, this is not a technique that we see.
Well, I'm so glad you noticed it. I mean, to be honest, I would say I'm kind of roughly guessing that maybe half of readers notice it at all. And I have had some, you know, critiques where it's like it's an okay book, but there's these terrible grammatical problems with the quotation marks. It's like, oh no, you know. So you nailed it. That's exactly what I decided to do. Was whenever Faina is a part of a conversation, there aren't any quotation marks. And what happened is once I started as I was writing along and I started writing the dialogue with Faina, when I put those quotation marks on, I had this kind of visceral reaction where I felt like, oh, I've just ruined her. Like, suddenly she feels very ordinary and just kind of smacked to the ground somehow in a way I couldn't really describe. And I'm a huge fan of a lot of writers like Cormac McCarthy who have done different things with dialogue. And so I experimented with just taking out all the quotation marks, and that didn't feel right. And then it did. It struck me. I thought, well, maybe if just these conversations are like that, it will lend, I hoped it would lend sort of an ethereal quality to her presence, her entire character. And I was super unfortunate with, very fortunate with both my agent and my editor that they wanted me to make it entirely my own, my book. At one point, my editor just said, walk me through why you did the quotation marks like that. And I explained it to her, and she said, yep, that's exactly what we were picturing. It's good. We're good to go. So I was very lucky that way to have a very supportive editorial staff.
But it's not so heavy-handed that the reader immediately thinks Faina is not real. And I assume it would be a mistake for us to interpret it that way.
Well, and I think that was the one risk that I took, that I have had some readers who have felt, even at the end, that she wasn't real in the sense that, like, she never really existed, that she was just completely in their imaginations, which is not at all what I intended. But what I do want, I want the reader to end thinking, is she just a human girl who has these amazing wilderness skills, or is she a magical creature? I mean, I wanted both those possibilities to survive the book, I guess.
And as their relationship grew, my attachment to Jack and Mabel grew because you feel this opportunity for them to finally have an experience as a parent. And to credit you as a writer again, you didn't make it so simple as saying, well, it's nice because now they feel like they have the child they never had, and, you know, isn't this sort of nice? It's a lot more complicated than that, and there were complex emotions with whether they felt right feeling like parents and some of the actions that followed that. Why did you bring their, or should we at least ask, is it fair to look at them as her parents at that moment? I mean, that was the moment in the book where I thought, okay, they're parents now. They're going to have what they need. But
right.
It wasn't so simple.
Well, and I guess I think, again, you know, I think I might have mentioned earlier, one of my goals was to kind of show Alaska for what part of what it really is. I think there's some idealized notions about Alaska. But there's also some idealized notions about parenthood, I think. And I was one of those, as a young woman, I really, really wanted children. And I just had these images of what that meant, you know, and it was sort of the soft golden glow and the warm little baby in your arms. And it's very simple-minded in that way. But the truth is, and I have a 14-year-old, a 6-year-old, I now understand, like, it is complicated. And even with children who are, your blood-born children, it's very complicated allowing them to be who they are, but at the same time trying to support them in good choices and all those things. And so Jack and Mabel kind of walked right into that with, and I think you're right, however they come to terms with it, they are parents to Faina, and I think she sees them that way as well.
We are going to take a quick break, and what I'd like to ask when we come back is the root of the name of the child. Joe and I were talking about how Faina got her name, and we're going to talk with Eowyn about that, and also some of the larger themes of the book that play out after they get to know Faina. So just a beautiful book, The Snow Child by Eowyn Ivey. It's if all of Rochester read the same book that chosen by Writers and Books. And Eowyn, thanks for being here. Why don't you hold right there, and we'll take a short break here and come right back on this Thursday afternoon. On Connections, I'm Evan Dawson, and you're listening to member-supported public radio.
As they look for the best job applicants they can get, bankers are trading in their suits for jeans.
The market that we're in is really competing for programmers, which is a very, very competitive market.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, old school bankers versus new school technology. In the world of high frequency trading, that's next time on Marketplace from APM.
Marketplace tonight at 6:30, right after All Things Considered, here on your public radio station, WXXI, and online at WXXINews.org.
All right, I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back on this Thursday afternoon. Eowyn Ivey, author of The Snow Child, is with us on the phone. From where are you in Alaska, Eowyn?
Well, I'm actually in our nearby town, which is Palmer. We're about, 60, 70 miles northeast of Anchorage, and so we're on the road system. Our house is actually another 30 miles northeast of here, in an area we call Chickaloon, although it's really not. It's a great community, but it's not much of a town. It's a very small small community.
How similar is the scenery near you to the scenery that we experience with Jack and Mabel and the rest of the characters in the book?
Right. It's very similar. And those people who live in what we call the Matanuska Valley, the river that flows through this valley is the Matanuska River, and those people who live here immediately recognize many of the places that I sort of referenced. But the reason I invented the Wolverine River is I realized as I was writing that I was very confined by true geography, very literal history and literal geography, and I found it kind of frustrating. I wanted to put things where I wanted them, and I knew that in a town like this, any kind of little error I made, someone would pick up on, whereas if I invent my own river, I can do whatever I want. But it's a very similar landscape, and there's even old coal mines in the area, a large agriculture community, things like that.
So the name of the child they encounter is Faina, and I'm curious to know if you can reveal a little bit more about how you chose that name.
Well, you know, with Jack and Mabel, I wanted to choose kind of very simple, almost traditional fairy tale kind of names, which Jack and Mabel, and Mabel was also my my great-grandmother's name, so that was kind of fun to get to name her after. But Faina, I wanted to have something a little magical, a little different, a little not quite what anyone, you know, what Jack and Mabel would expect. And in kind of in honor of the Russian fairy tale, I started looking a lot through Russian names, and I came across Faina, and it said that it had meant having to do with light. And immediately I thought of the Alpenglow here on the mountains in Alaska. So that was kind of, I had fun with sort of making the name into what I wanted it, the purpose I wanted it to serve with Faina.
How much should we read into the relationship with her fox?
Well, I think it is significant, although that developed for me. You know, in the original story, there is a fox, or at least in one of the versions, the Arthur Ransom version, there is a fox who helps the little girl find her way out of the woods where she's gotten lost. And so I came across the fox in that original story, and my imagination started kind of growing with it. And then as I wrote it, when I was sharing it with my editor, she had some great insight about the role kind of the fox as Faina's wild guardian. And when the fox is no longer there, things start to change for Faina. So I think he does play kind of a role.
Now, there's a woman named Esther who is probably the strongest person in the book. We meet Esther, and she's just beheaded a turkey, and she's carrying this flopping body around. That's a frontier woman there. And very interesting relationship develops with Jack and Mabel and Esther and George and their family, and especially their sons. And we learn more about Garrett and the kids there because Jack has to do something very, very important. He's got to kill a moose early on in the winter to have a chance for them to be fed all winter long. First of all, for readers like us who've never had to kill a moose, hoping to have meat for the winter, that's real life, and especially at that time then, wasn't it? I mean, those are the things that you have to do if you want to survive the winter.
Absolutely. And even, even when I was a little girl, families that didn't have a lot of money, having moose meat and salmon in the freezer, that was kind of what got you through the winter. And we live a similar lifestyle. I mean, we're fortunate enough to almost always have moose and caribou in the freezer. It's how we get through the year. But we have the option of going to the grocery store if we need to. For Jack and Mabel, it is a very real need that they need to fill. It was fun for me to write Jack's character because he's not a hunter. I mean, I grew up in a hunting family. It's very much a part of my life. I wanted to imagine what would it be like to suddenly be in the situation where you've got to hunt down a moose and butcher the meat and do all these things when it's not something that you're not familiar with.
You have to find a moose first, especially later in the season for them. He's missed a bit of a window. He's got to find a moose, kill it, and then get the meat back for a guy who's not much of a hunter. Eowyn, moose or caribou, what do you prefer?
You captured the big question in Alaska. This is the great debate. And it's funny because I'm one of those ones, I love caribou meat, but I will never turn down moose meat. But caribou meat is a little bit of a finer grained meat, very flavorful, and I love it.
Have you killed a moose?
I have killed a moose. And, I have to say that was one of the things I was a little nervous about with the book. it's so much a part of our lives up here, but I know it can be foreign and a little jarring to other people, and I did not know how it would be received. And I have gotten here and there some fairly negative feedback about the hunting elements of the book or the hunting, you know, aspect of my own life. And I just hope that, you know, I've been fortunate enough to be able to talk to people a little bit about the role it plays in our lives, that it's not about sport, it's about food, you know, which is a very different reality.
Well, and I think that is, you know, I may not be a hunter myself, but I didn't find any parts of it at all obscene or objectionable, because it is very clear that this is a austere and raw frontier life we're looking at, and that he's doing it. Jack wasn't even comfortable necessarily doing it, but knew he had to do it. And I think you wrote that scene, which was, you know, an emotional, important scene. I think you wrote it very nicely. And fortunately for him, and by the way, I should back up and say, it was Faina who helped him out, whether he knew it or not. And as a reader, I took it as the cue to say, if this girl is real, she is very well tuned to the wilderness, because it's almost like she knew he needed that moose and she led him to it.
Yeah, exactly. And I kind of like the idea that she's been watching them maybe a little, and she knows a little bit about what they need. And like you say, that she knows a little bit more about the world around them than they do. So I think she does. And that's, I you know, I was a huge fan as a little girl. I love, like, the Little House on the Prairie books and Island of the Blue Dolphins and different things where children were living in pretty extreme situations and doing well. And so for me, Faina was sort of the embodiment of that, I think.
And so he not only takes down the moose, but it's not that simple. I mean, this is not Oregon Trail where, you know, you shoot a bear and you get how many hundreds of pounds of meat and magically it's back in your wagon. I mean, it's going to take the rest of the day to have to bring that meat back. And fortunately for him, not far away and hearing the gunshots was Garrett, who was a 13, right? A 13-year-old. And Garrett is well-schooled in this stuff, and he helps him out. And they develop more of a relationship. But then we learn that Garrett and Faina, and we're jumping ahead a little bit here, but it's interesting. I talked to somebody this morning who read the book and said that was the one part of the book where they felt they didn't know if they were, if they, not that they weren't okay with it, but they felt a little uncomfortable as Garrett and Faina develop a relationship.
Right. And I do think it is somewhat of an uncomfortable situation, but I think that's the reality of us, you know, that parents deal with as their children get older and develop into young adults. And I did, you know, and that is one of the versions of the fairy tale. There's a version of the fairy tale in which the snow child chooses mortality so that she can marry a young man. And as I was scrolling through all the different versions, I thought, wow, that's a heartbreaking story to imagine. You know, what does that mean? So that was kind of the route that I wanted to see where this relationship would take them.
Jack's response to that relationship, for me, was very important as a reader to kind of watch him, his discomfort with it. What did you want to make sure that you accomplished in writing those scenes?
Well, again, that complexity of parenthood, of loving a child and then, you know, guiding them, wanting to protect them, but also having to let go a little bit. And I thought it was, you know, touching and a little heartbreaking that he sees Garrett totally as the wrong guy, you know, the one who's done the wrong, and kind of can't quite imagine Faina as being anything but this perfect, pure little girl. So it is it's a transformation he has to kind of accept, I think.
What has been the reader feedback to that relationship, to Garrett and Faina?
You know, it's interesting because I get, it's funny for me, and I shouldn't do this. I do read all my reviews online. I should stop, but I do it. I can't seem to stop myself. It's funny because, you know, the people that have strong feelings about the ending, it goes both ways. For some people, they say, gosh, the beginning was kind of dull and sad, and then it really picks up at the end, and I love the ending. And other people say, I love the beginning, and I didn't like the ending, you know. So I think it maybe depends on the type of book you like and what your tastes are. It's that thing, and as a bookseller, I realized long ago that no book can satisfy everyone, you know. So there's going to be people that enjoy certain aspects of it, but perhaps not others.
And we're not going to give away the ending, but I will ask you, when you approached the ending, did you know as a writer how you wanted to wrap it up, or were you sort of discovering that as you wrote?
You know, I realized fairly early on what was basically going to happen in the end. But there were parts of me that thought, oh, is this really the way I want to go emotionally? You know, but I knew, deep down I knew it was the ending that would be there. And I hoped that it would also leave a little bit of hope at the end. And I always want, I met a really nice elderly man a while back, and he said, well, I liked your book, but I didn't like the ending. And I realized as we were talking that he hadn't read the epilogue. And I do feel that my epilogue is very important because it, I think, opens up another world of potential there.
How important was it to you not to have a pat, let me explain everything about the nature of this character ending?
You know, and that's another matter thing, a matter of taste, I think. And I've gotten a lot of reactions. That's probably the biggest question I get is, who was Faina really and what happened to her in the end? And I am always hesitant to explain a lot. For me, as a reader, I like that feeling of having a little room at the ending of a book to sort of imagine and mull something over. But other people, and I understand this, other people really want a concrete answer at the end, and this book isn't going to give it to you. So, not everyone likes that kind of way to go at the end.
Well, we're talking to Eowyn Ivey, the author of The Snow Child. She's going to be here in a couple of weeks for Writers and Books, and her book was selected as What If All of Rochester Read the Same Book. Joe Flaherty, with the executive director of Writers and Books, is here, and so let me ask you this, Joe. I mean, any trouble with the ending for you? Do you appreciate allowing a little room for interpretation?
Oh, I think that's part of the magic of this book. First of all, once you know what the original fairy tale is, it's going to be very hard for an author to do something that's different than that. Although it's interesting, Eowyn, when you have the package that arrives from Mabel's sister, and in it she says, you know, I do have to tell you, this one's in Russian, but every version I've seen, it doesn't end happily or something like that. But we can all write our own endings. So, you know, when I read that, I was thinking, well, maybe there is a different ending. But I have no trouble with it at all. But I did want to ask you, the epilogue, at what point, I mean, when you had finished the book, did you think that was it? I mean, or did you have the epilogue in mind at that point, or did you feel you had to write that? How did that come about?
You know, I actually, the very, very last scene in the book, in the epilogue, I knew from very early on. Mm-hmm. I had it in my head. And so it was just sort of a, you know, arbitrary decision to call it the epilogue. I mean, it does take place towards, you know, later in time and things like that. But for me, it's very much a part of the story. And like I said, I think those last few lines I had in my head for a long, long time. And so trying to figure out how I was going to get there and everything in between. But for me, it was very much a part of the story.
And I don't have the passage in front of me that Joe's referring to, but I believe there was the line said essentially something like, we can choose joy over sorrow. Such a large overriding theme every time when it seems so dark, I felt like the author was telling me that, you know, there's still hope in the wilderness.
Well, and you know, and I think going back to what you were saying about the snowball scene, you know, the snowy scene, for me that's really what it was about. Was it was about Mabel embracing that little moment in time where you can just have a little fun. And I think I had this, you know, part of it was as I was writing this book, a very dear friend of mine, same age as me, with a little girl about the same age as my daughter, died of cancer. And I had this realization that it's inevitable that we lose people, you know, the little baby they lose. There's death, you know, throughout the book, to be honest, in different forms. And that's inevitable. That's part of it. For me, I wanted to say, to kind of look into how do we survive that? Not just survive, but how do we enjoy life in the face of that? And I think that was sort of the transformation I wanted Jack and Mabel to go through, was to be able to find those little moments of joy in life.
Have you heard from parents who've lost children?
You know, I have, and I can say that's probably been one of the most moving aspects of the book. And to be honest, I didn't really, you know, I just didn't expect it, I guess. But I've been very fortunate to be able to talk with some people who've been able to share their emotions about, you know, either having gone through stillbirth or infertility. And I've been glad to feel that the people that I've talked with so far have all felt like it was, that they enjoyed the story and it touched a place in them. So that meant a lot to me.
When you read the reviews of The Snow Child, it looks like a cabal of sycophants. I mean, it's just really a remarkable chain of one after another of newspapers and reviewers who have loved it. And when you're writing The Snow Child, I mean, no first-time author has any clue where it's going, if it's going to be read, if it's going to have an audience. When did you know that this was breaking out?
You know, I never knew. And to be honest, I still pinch myself. I mean, it's, you know, I think especially coming from a bookseller background, I know how hard it is for books even that I've really loved that just never quite get the traction, you know. And to be honest, I think there's a lot of elements that an author can't control, just different things that happen along the way. But as I was writing it, I did have this sort of excited, kind of tingly feeling inside, like I was excited about the story. But I knew enough to not expect that anyone else in the world would be excited about it just because I was. So the whole thing has been a wonderful, marvelous surprise for me and my family.
How quickly did you see the reviews?
You know, it was such a strange experience because what happened, so much of my experience was very contrary to how I understood publishing. For example, when it was acquired here in the U.S., it was simultaneously acquired by publishers in other countries. And one of those was Norway. And Norway chose to publish earlier than anywhere else. So before it had ever come out here in the United States, before I'd ever actually seen, you know, the book in print, it was coming out in Norway and very quickly ended up on their bestseller list. And I was just shocked. And there were positive blog reviews coming in. It was just beyond any dreams that I had imagined.
And this is where I feel totally unprepared as an interviewer. And so forgive me. So let me ask you just a dumb question, but I'm going to ask you anyway. There's got to be some film rights or something going on.
No, that's not a dumb question at all. You know, there has been some interest, nothing that's come of it yet. And, you know, it would be exciting in ways, but, you know, it's a little nerve-making in ways, too. But one thing I'm really excited about is there's a composer in the U.K., Eric Wetherill, who is composing an opera based on the book. And I think he's getting ready to try to produce it this next year sometime. And I've read the libretto, and it's just very exciting to see it sort of, you know, transform through another artist's eyes like that.
Wow.
I mean, yeah, it's kind of amazing.
That's got to be a remarkable honor for it to be. Forget movies. If you get a librettist to work with you, you've done something pretty special. No, I mean, you know, I have a friend who used to be based in Rochester. She's a fiction writer, and now she's on the West Coast. And her newest book is, they are in discussions. It's been optioned for a film.
Oh, wonderful. And,
but she had to debate with herself, am I comfortable with other people taking control of a story that I wrote? Because there's ultimately, there will be changes. How difficult would that be to part with some of that control?
Well, and, you know, even with this opera, and of course it's not on the scale of a film, but with this opera, he certainly had to take scenes out and sort of compress time and do different things just by the limitations of the form. And, you know, it's exciting to see someone else transform it. I do feel that there's certain elements. It's just like when discussions came up about the book cover, because the author doesn't design the cover or usually have much say over it. And the only thing, I just had little silly things that I feel like, I want it to be true to Alaska. I want it to be true to the characters. And I said, you know, so please don't put maple trees on the cover. We don't have maple trees in Alaska. So there's little things to make it authentic to the characters and to the place, I think.
Awen Ivey is the author of The Snow Child. I'm with us for just a few more minutes. Go ahead. Joe, go ahead.
Yes, Awen, I wanted to ask you, you had mentioned that Norway had picked it up as a publisher of the book. And I'm wondering, there's been people who have written about the certain kind of stories that come from the Arctic Circle or countries that, you know, that bridge up to that. And I'm wondering, have there been other ones? Has it been published in Russia? Have there been other countries like that, Sweden, in which you've gotten a response to it?
Well, that is such a great question. It's been really funny. First of all, let me say, most surprising of all to me, I mean, I never imagined it would be published in a foreign country. But if someone said to me, it'll be published in what one country, what is it? I would thought, well, maybe Russia. And Russia's the one country that hasn't done it. So that's kind of been a funny surprise. But I think we're up to 25-some translations, 30-some countries. It's been amazing. But I have this theory that I've been able to observe that the closer you are to either pole, the better the book is received. So it's done really well in New Zealand, not so well in South America, you know, well in Canada, like you mentioned, Sweden, Norway, places like that, Finland. So it does make me wonder if there isn't something about the landscape, the lifestyle that maybe speaks to people that live in a little more extreme climates like that.
And you were working on a different book when you, and if our listeners missed the story earlier, Awen was working on a separate book, was pretty well through with it. I mean, what, three-quarters through, Awen?
Right, right.
And all of a sudden was struck with the idea for The Snow Child and then shifted off and did that, and I would say it's worked out just fine. But What's coming next from you?
Well, I am working on another book. That first novel, to be honest, I think was my practice run, which is, I always feel like that's a little daunting to writers to know that, but it was. But now I'm working on a totally different book, and it's set on that same Wolverine River that I invented in The Snow Child. It's called Shadows on the Wolverine, and it's set in 1885. It tells the story, it's based on a true life story of a military expedition that went up into the heart of Alaska, sort of traversed Alaska, and some people have called it the Lewis and Clark of Alaska. But my characters are fictionalized, and they're encountering some surprising, fantastical, mythological things along the way. So I'm hoping to get it to my publisher this summer, and we'll go from there.
Have they given you sort of a green light? I mean, you've built a little capital up with the success of The Snow Child, I imagine.
Well, I've been so fortunate with my publisher. Little Brown & Company has been really supportive of me, and I am working with them on this next one and excited. And my agent, too. It's been amazing for me to see the editing skills that my agent has, so I'm really looking forward to I'll get my draft to him, and then I'll send it on to Little Brown & Company, and we'll see how it goes from there.
Snow Child set in 1920, your forthcoming book, 1885, and in the austerity of Alaska, there's probably a lot that is still close to the same today, but there's some that isn't. How much research goes into making sure you're setting scenes correctly?
Well, it was interesting because with The Snow Child, to be honest, I did very little research because their lifestyle is close enough to how we live mm-hmm. that I didn't have to, research how to butcher a moose or things like that. I did research a little bit the Homesteading Act of the time and homesteaders coming up here, the farming techniques. The new book is requiring a great deal of research, but it is so much fun. I'm really learning a lot, everything from ornithology to, the kind of field equipment that they would be bringing on an expedition like this. It's just, native history here in Alaska with the indigenous people. It's really been a lot of fun.
Joe Flaherty from Writers and Books, why don't you go over one more time for our listeners if they missed the schedule coming up with AO and Ivy and with surrounding this book?
Well, there's some really interesting things happening before Eowyn gets here, and let me just mention a few of those, one of which is out at Mendon Ponds Park this Saturday. There's going to be a program called Surviving in the Snow, and it's for ages 8 and up, and it's a great chance for families to kind of go out in this winter, which has been a harsh one for us, and discover that in the same way that have a better sense of what takes place in the novel. We're also having a snow day party this Friday night at Writers and Books, and as part of it, we have taken little miniature foxes that have been hidden at a number of galleries throughout the community, and it's first Friday, and a lot of galleries are open, but there is a list they can check, and if they discover one of those little foxes, they can come to Writers and Books and get a free copy of the Snow Child. And we'll also be having a lot of refreshments that night. For instance, we're having some chocolate mousse desserts and some fox run wine.
I've never had real mousse, but chocolate mousse, it beats the pants off of it.
But also this Saturday at the Hochstein Music School, there's going to be music and dance that is based on music that is comes from what they're calling it Flights of Winter Fantasy. There is an exhibit of photographs right down the block from where Writers and Books is in a gallery, and it's they're all winter photographs. And there's also going to be an exhibit of quilts, which have been inspired by local quilt makers after having read The Snow Child. And an exhibit of those is going to be at Penfield Public Library. So that is preceding when Eowyn gets here. But then starting on Wednesday, March 19th, it's going to be all Eowyn, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And those events take place throughout the community, and people can find out about those by checking on our website.
They've stacked up the schedule, Eowyn. Isn't that pretty impressive?
Oh, I was just wanting to break in and say I'm so impressed with everything that you all have done to celebrate books. It's just I've seen some other events like this around the country where communities come together around one book, and it's a really moving, wonderful thing, and I'm really impressed. I saw on Twitter the picture of the little foxes, and they're adorable. It's just a wonderful idea, so I hope you have a lot of fun, and I can't wait to see it all there in person.
Well, one of the things that authors tell us, this is our 14th year of doing the program, but to come to a community where thousands and thousands of people have all read the book and are just dying to talk about it, as opposed to going someplace where you have to introduce what the book's about, is just such a great experience for them, because they hear from people different ways that they've interpreted the book, what the book has meant to them, how they've taken their own life experiences as readers and, you know, layered that onto and taken, you know, from the book. And it's always just a wonderful, exciting experience to hear people talk about what the book meant to them.
And Eowyn, before I let you go, speaking of that, what the book meant to them, when you hear readers, I mean, I imagine the most common question is, you know, sort of a this existential nature of it, like what exactly was Faina, et cetera. But
right.
Do you hear from readers who say, I've got it figured out, it's X, and in your mind it's wrong, and do you have an urge to correct them, or do you say everybody interprets it their own way?
Well, you know, that's been a really interesting realization for me that I did not expect, and it was this realization that once a book is out in the world, it doesn't belong to the author anymore. And so I can't say your answer is wrong, because their answer is just as right as what maybe I was thinking at the time. And I realize that because as I read books, they're my books. I have a certain sense of ownership. This is what I know it means, and this is what I've taken away. And all readers bring different experiences, and that's part of the experience of the text is what they're bringing to it. So it's really fun for me. I have had many occasions where readers have discovered something in the text that I didn't realize was there, and it wasn't wrong at all. It was entirely right. I just didn't have the foresight to realize that's what it was saying. So it's been a really fun experience for me as a writer to kind of see it through a reader's eye.
Once in a while, readers can surprise you, and it's not that they're picking up on things that aren't there, but that they really do like to peel back layers of meaning, which is probably so much fun for you.
Absolutely.
We've loved the conversation, and the book is beautiful, and I really appreciate you taking the time for us, because I know you're all the way in Alaska now, but we're going to see you here in a couple of weeks, so thanks for taking the time.
Oh, thank you so much, Evan and Joe. It was really wonderful to get to talk with you, and I'm so looking forward to my trip to Rochester.
Also, we are too.
Cheers, Eowyn. That's Eowyn Ivey, the author of The Snow Child, and come in here. Joe, last thoughts on the conversation.
Well, I think it just kind of lets people know what a wonderful kind of person we have coming here.
You do not have to doubt the validity of your choice now, do you?
No. You know, it's interesting because, you know, people don't know. I mean, sometimes people say, well, you know, writers are so, you know, introspective and who knows whether they'll be good and, you know, with crowds and with audiences. And everyone we've chosen has been. And so it's just a great event, and we look forward to doing it every year.
The website with the schedule of events.
www.wab.org.
WAB.org for the schedule of events. And yeah, you've chosen well. And think about the honor that is with all the possible choices out there. Thank you, Joe. Thanks for being here. This was great fun.
Thank you, Evan.
What if all of Rochester read the same book? This year it's The Snow Child. Thank you for joining us on this Thursday. Arts Friday tomorrow. Can't wait to see you right back here at noon on Connections Then. Have a great day.